Let me make sure I get this right. Okay. They fit this, so I don't make a mistake, but our next speaker will be Catherine Kinsley.
Okay. Hi, I'm Kay Kinsley. I'm from Philadelphia. I want to welcome all of you on a Wednesday morning. Thank you very much. It means you really care about children and parents. And I want to introduce my co-presenter, Suzanne Mensch, who is a newly minted, I think, public health social worker. This is her first time at APHI. So welcome her. I also want you to leave with three things. A social smile by 12 months, stacking two blocks by 18 months. And when we speak about autism, we're really speaking about autism spectrum disorder. And I just added a postscript is that me being a seasoned nurse, I've learned a lot about this project that I humbly had not been involved with before. That's more in the arena of general public health. So I want to tell you a story about how we took charge when change was needed. And we will only describe part of what we've done because we're still in the 2008-2009 session. We have no financial relationships or any commercial interests with this project. But we all know that we face unique challenges when we work with underserved populations. We don't always have the time or the money to enhance our clinical skills, regardless of what we want to do as far as going to meetings. And we always know about our need, our resources. And sometimes when you recognize an unmet need, you have to figure out how to address it. And we wanted to share what we consider a very innovative, exciting, and sort of unpredictable program. And I really wanted all of us, regardless of where we practice or educate our students or conduct research, to realize that some of our silent, most needy children and families reside in pockets of impoverishment, be they rural or urban. And that you can't look at a child without looking at the caregivers. Regardless of how you get compensated, you cannot look at the child without the spectrum of people who care about and for that child. And I really want us to begin a dialogue about how we can develop public health initiatives that don't sit within the general framework for reimbursement or appropriate resources. These are some definitions that you can find regarding autism. They frame our work. We are using this one from the Autism Society of America, which recognizes it's a complex developmental disability that happens within the first 3 years of life, and it affects a person's ability to communicate and interact. And for most of us, we intuitively know when a child isn't right. Doesn't mean that they're not normal, but there's something about that child. For most of us who are in the provider world, you don't know what it is, but you have a nudge or an intuition that there's something sort of off. Well, these are the statistics for today, and they are going to change. One out of 150 is diagnosed. In New Jersey, it's one out of 98. We can't figure out whether New Jersey has a great program, so people go to New Jersey and live. But at any rate, it's a little different from state to state. More males are affected than females. It doesn't discriminate among any group. It's more prevalent than the diseases that we've been concerned about in the past. And that we know how to recognize, refer, diagnose, and link our child and family to appropriate services early. So regardless of what I thought before I started this, I'm on a mission that you find them before they're three, and Suzanne would reinforce that too. And that research does show that if you participate, if that child and family participate in early intervention, it is the best determinant of their future outcomes. Dr. David Mandel, who is also here at APHA, did a research in 2002 that said white children were diagnosed earlier than black children in the school district of Philadelphia. Well, shame on all of us, because that means they were diagnosed even when they were in the schools. Where were these children undetected before they came to the school district? And there's obviously, and I've discovered this, we've all discovered there's a dearth in primary care providers and public health professionals that have enough formal education to be able to implement any sort of recognition or assessment. And there's a compelling need to do screenings in primary care practices, be them nurse-managed centers, primary care provider offices, pediatrician offices, about doing ASD screenings at 18, 24, and 36-month well-child visits. Well, because I'm responsible for a nurse-family partnership program in Philadelphia, we do work with the nurses, and they have clinical conferences that reported that family disintegration and lack of family-focused services for the very young child limited their clients if they were either not doing well on ages and stages screenings or if they were suspected of autism. And our nurses start at 4 months to do the ages and stages screening until the child is 2 months old. And also we knew abysmally it was a 24-month wait for an evaluation and diagnosis by a developmental specialist. So we had the opportunity to submit a grant to the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare and its newly created Bureau of Autism Services. I could talk about that, but it really was created by Estelle Richmond and two dedicated social workers whose children had autism, or at the time ASD, but we're going to call it autism to be short, who over 10 to 14 years bent Estelle's ear about the fact that there needed to be a formalized system for meeting the needs of children with autism in Pennsylvania. That grant proposal got written about 5 times before they even funded it for a variety of reasons. And it really was to focus on our public health initiatives to promote early recognition. And our intent was to keep the model as nurse-family partnership to work with our inner-city, lower-income, largely minority families residing in our higher-risk neighborhoods. Although we could serve the entire city, we also knew that we'd probably have a definite emergence of children that we had already suspected would be at risk. So our goal was to emphasize earlier diagnosis and early intervention and to recognize that there is a heightened community awareness of ASD. But, I mean, it's like every day you can read something or hear something about autism. 3 years ago, you may not have heard the same thing. But the obvious lack of high-quality community-based services were of concern. And that we also wanted to understand, as I mentioned before, the issues around why a family who might be referred to a different kind of system, including early intervention, may in fact not be engaged on having ongoing engagement with it. So we call this a child-centered, family-focused, community-based program. And that we wanted to do 3 things. We wanted to do education to our providers and our public health community. We wanted to be able to do outreach as best we could to those people who, one, knew of children who might be at risk or newly diagnosed. And we wanted to create a model of a home visitation model. Since that's part of my public health mantra, you work with a family where they are. So the initial year of funding, we had two public health nurses, a family counselor, myself, and a data entry person, who, by the way, is a master's prepared public health nurse, so she knows how to read everything and do it. And the argument was someone wanted to give us a paraprofessional enter the data, and I said, absolutely not. We could not do that. It was too critical for us to have information that meant something to us. And I needed to understand all the big words, so that's what we did. I must add that we added Suzanne the second year because our two public health nurses, who were very seasoned, said we need a social worker. Mm-hmm. And they found Suzanne. And then they came and they said, we found a social worker who knows all about autism. So I courted and recruited her for 3 months before we knew we had the funding. I must tell you that it was a wonderful gift for us. So we conducted provider education with our nurse-managed centers, with our nurses who were in the Nurse Family Partnership Program. We reached out to federally qualified health centers, and I'm going to pass around what I developed. It's just one form. You send us an email, we'll send it to you, about what MCHAT is, which is a modified checklist for autism in toddlers. This is not the only screening form that you can do, but this is what we introduced to the providers. They have now included in their electronic medical record. They're supposed to be doing a hearing test and a lead screening. If these children do not do, they call it if you fail MCHAT. I don't like that term. You don't fail MCHAT. You just are not meeting what those particular criteria happen to be at that point in the child's life. A family member can do it. Usually a caregiver does it. Typically, but for our individuals who may not have a high reading level, sometimes we do this one-on-one. So you'll see what I developed for them, what the screening tool is, what particular questions that if they do not respond favorably means that they quote have failed, what you have to do. And then the nurse practitioner said, you have to put in, because it was just, can the child build a tower of blocks? They made me identify what months you could do these blocks. So you'll see, and then you'll see the crib sheet at the end, all right, which gives you the answers. I can tell you, no one was doing MCHAT. They are really wedded to Denver. And yet Denver does not have the reliability and validity that MCHAT does. But convincing them that this might be a transition, when in fact they perceived it as more work, was very difficult. And then we arranged that every month we would call them to find out if any child had difficulty, and then we would refer them to the First Steps program to be able to help the family know that they would have a wait for diagnosis and be able to work through the suspicions that they might have about what was, quote, wrong with their child. We really want to build in the thing, a component of family advocacy and the ability to follow up or short-term case management, as we said, with some mobile therapy through our consultant who is a family therapist. And we really wanted to figure out how we could do some public policy work over time. So as you can see, I'm going to identify some of what Suzanne has really enriched the program with, because she has developed a liaison work with our local developmental pediatricians, and now they all want her to come to work with them. So she's developed a resource guide for professionals and families in the Philadelphia area in consultation with the other social workers and professionals involved in the autism world. She participates in a special needs task force, and we've coordinated additional trainings for social work and educational providers in the community. And we also have been on this mission to share it with public health professionals, students, social worker students. So what do you think? Over our time, and we haven't, you know, this is all cumulative, so this is only at a given point in time. The average age of the child referred to our program was 5, but we had 2 to 15-year-olds with some outliers. We had some colleagues whose children had just turned 18 or 19 have Asperger's and weren't really struggling with resources, so we also informally provided assistance to them. Now, obviously, 70% of them are male, and we also have sibling groups. So our sibling groups, we have made up 2 or 3 children with a diagnosis now in the household. And I would say that we specifically reached our target population of more of a minority group inner city. You see the characteristics of our caregivers. Most of them are alone. They don't have social support. If you look at the 41% married, but if 20% are separated, you would appreciate the dynamics in the household. And over half of them are unemployed, and many of them live in substandard housing. And I would say, in many respects in my category, I call public housing substandard. I don't think I see anywhere. Let me go back. These are the reasons for the referrals. And most of our referrals have come from pediatricians or developmental specialists, but on the other hand, we've received them from ChildLink, which is early intervention services, from family members who've heard about the program. I'm specifically focusing right now on our direct delivery, which is our home visitation program, and not speaking so much about the educational component. And Suzanne now is going to share her clinical case presentations, because I think telling an individual story about who we've worked with, why we've worked with them, and some of our outcomes is significant, and it brings meaning to our program. And the reason we call it First Steps is because we envision this as being the first step that we can help families with these children take to help their child be healthier and hopefully more able to start school. Okay, Suzanne, thank you.
Thank you. My introduction to the world of public health has been really great.
So I thought that when I think about what I do and what I've done over the last year, prior to coming to work for this program, I worked with the intermediate units in our area, which provide the special education services to children in the area, in 2 counties that were predominantly upper middle class families and families that could privately pay for services. So coming into this project, I was thinking, wow, this is very different than what I'm used to, and quite frankly, I was very scared. But I did it, and so when I think about the cases that really bring to life what this program is about, 3 or 4 cases come to mind, and I'll go quickly. The first was a family that had 6 children living in a 1-room apartment. Mom was undocumented, and dad was just recently diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And they had moved from Virginia, and dad had not been medicated. He had been on medication and then not medicated because they didn't have health insurance. None of the children had health insurance, didn't know how to go about getting health insurance. They were going to one of the local clinics, and one of the nurses there, after going through the program of being trained on the MCHAT, had identified this child as having needs. And the child was given the MCHAT twice, and continue to not meet the requirements. And so he was referred to the program. And when I got to the home, it was very shocking to me to see the conditions that the family was living in. And I'm thinking, well, no wonder autism is sort of the last thing. They didn't even know what autism was, much less what to do about the fact that they had no health insurance. Mom was constantly worried about whether or not they were going to have food to feed their children. When I sat in their living room, there was a large hole in the middle of the living room floor, which, depending on the time of day and year that I was there, had any number of things coming up through it, and you could see the ground from the floor. And so there was a lot of things going on with this family, and, you know, I was sort of like, where to start, you know. But we were able to get all the children health insurance through the medical assistance, and we were also able to connect Dad to a local health clinic where he receives weekly counseling and medication. He was denied health insurance, so we're still kind of working on how to get that going. And also the child was deemed eligible for SSI. So now the family has a steady amount of income coming in, and they're really looking to see if they can move out of the place that they're at, which, you know, on any given day has, you know, a large amount of crime happening right outside of their door. And the next case was just, you know, a family who, you know, mom was very involved with her child and, you know, kept saying to the doctor, something's wrong, something's not right. My child used to say 20 words, and now my child is saying nothing. And the doctor just kept telling them, oh, he's a boy. Just hang on. Just wait. It'll come. You know, he's just developing this way. And the mom's like, no, really, there's something wrong with my child. And, you know, there were limited places where families can go because of the insurance that they have. So to go to another provider to get a second opinion, you know, she just didn't do that. And she trusted, quite frankly, she trusted her doctor. That was the person who was in charge of her son's care. And finally, he was diagnosed at age 4 after mom had been talking to them for 2 years about the fact that there was something going on with her son. The third family, you know, sort of in my enthusiasm when I took this position, I had a family that lived in a housing complex and went into the home, and it was just completely dark, like so dark that I couldn't even do my paperwork, despite it being, you know, 9 o'clock on, you know, any given weekday morning. The shades were drawn. There was no light. There was one little light in the kitchen, and that was it. And I wasn't, you know, quite sure, and I was talking to some folks, and they said, well, you know, a lot of the families are really concerned about what other people think about people coming into their homes, and so they, you know, close the blinds so people don't know what's happening. But mom was also just really, really depressed, and so I was thinking, okay, well, you know, we could get her to get out with the kids. This was a mom who also had 3 kids who had autism. And so, you know, we were trying to get them to go out for walks. And after a couple weeks of pushing, like, let's go out and do something. You know, I'll go with you. I'll go to the park. And mom finally said to me, she's like, you know, she's like, 3 people have been murdered in my neighborhood in the last month. She said, I am not taking my children out there, regardless of the time of the day, to walk around. And so it really brought, you know, home to me the fact that, you know, I could have all these great interventions, but I really had to be aware of what was going on in the neighborhood. And through myself and the counselor that works with our program, we were able to work with mom. And I still remember the day that I walked in, and she had gone out to Target and bought, you know, new blinds for the house that kind of, they were sheer, so it still let the light in, but it was still very, you know, she was still feeling protected. But she had gotten new coverings for the couch, and it was amazing just to see kind of the difference in her affect and her presentation just with these little changes. And by the end of her work in the program, she had actually made a self-portrait for the counselor that had worked with her. And just the different, like, we didn't even know she was an artist. Like, there were all these things coming out. Like, she had played the violin, and she had stopped, basically, all these things because she had to care for her children and didn't really know how to move on past that. So we were able to really bring that back for her. And then just the last family, I mean, really basic kind of collaboration where the schools don't really know what's happening necessarily in the homes, and the doctors in their offices are telling parents to do different things, but so there was a child who was 8 years old and was highly self-injurious at school, and no one could figure out why. The developmental pediatrician couldn't figure out why, and so they made a referral to me in the program and went out to the home and met with mom a couple of times. She was very lovely. You know, home was, you know, fine, and she really didn't give much as to what was going on with her son. After three or four visits, mom finally revealed to me that they haven't had food or adequate supplies of food for about a month and a half. And so we were able to hook them up with a local food bank. And once the child was able to get consistent food, his self-injury went down almost to nothing. But it was like the doctors didn't know to ask, didn't ask mom that. The school didn't think to ask mom that. He was getting breakfast at school, which is what they provide, and I guess lunch. But we also know that children who have autism are very picky eaters. So we were able to find food that he could eat and food that was able to sustain him, and the self-injury decreased. So it really speaks to the ability to kind of work with providers to look at the whole child and the whole family and find out what's going on. And that's been amazing to be in this program and to be able to work with the doctors and help them understand what's going on at home and helping, you know, the folks at home understand why the doctors are concerned and why the school is concerned. And it's just an honor to be in that job and with this program. So thank you.
Thank you. In the interest of time, I saw the 5 minutes and the 1 minute slip. So. Well, obviously we've exposed something that in the city of Philadelphia of 1.5 million people, that we have still a dearth of needed community and family support. We have an obligation to prepare students and providers to recognize and refer early children suspected of autism. It doesn't mean that they will be diagnosed, and we cannot, as public health providers, make diagnosis in the Commonwealth. But we can link them to a site or an entity that could do that. But then you have to understand it's a 24-month wait. And we have an unrecognized need still with so many inner city families, and we have a need for a program like this. We did learn over time that providers are not necessarily motivated to change current developmental screening protocols because of time and money, except recently DPW said that they will reimburse providers for screenings. They don't have opportunities to learn more about ASD, and that we have found that prevention and early intervention continues to not be as valued or reimbursed as traditional chronic disease management. We also have humbly learned that it is a family affair with lifelong implications, so that we ourselves need to be obligated to work with families so their children, as they grow up to be young adults and now more maturing adults, will be more productive in our society. So what's our funding? Uncertain. We thought we could bill medical assistance, but MA only requires you to have certain provider status numbers, which has been difficult for us as a small entity to acquire. And it all looks for billing for the child and doesn't look at the family unit, so that makes it very challenging. For policy, though, in the Commonwealth, DPW has just passed new legislation, which allows for private insurance to cover up to $36,000 a year for services, and then DPW will pick it up later. And we do think there are replication opportunities, but I'd like to be able to say that we had more funding so we could continue it over time. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Amy Cork, and Amy will speak to us on childhood obesity.
Oh, there's really not a space for my water.
Yeah, there's. Just wait.